Chapter 54. Christina. Clover Bar, London. January 1917. Gerald carefully wraps the final Christmas bauble in a page from the London Illustrated News and tucks it into the cardboard box. He scans the denuded Christmas tree, a generous gift from the Jeffreys from a wood near Nuneaton, and ducks under the branches to winch the base out of the metal stand. Gerald, whatever are you doing down there? I'm putting away the decorations, my dear. Gerald, get off the floor. I've asked Hetty to do that when she's finished the laundry. She agreed on the condition we pay her an additional 5 shillings. She said it was outside her agreed contract of work. Whatever is the world coming to? If only Millie hadn't absconded to the munitions factory. Why any young woman would wish to work in such a place is beyond me. I enjoy putting the decorations away, Tina. I remember where we bought each and every one of them. And this tree's far too heavy for Hetty. I'll have the rag and bone man take it away tomorrow. Gerald rises to his feet, the liberated tree in his grasp. A shower of needles drops onto the Persian rug. Look what you've done now. We'll be picking spruce needles out of the rug until Easter. Honestly, Gerald, your photography studio is quite untidy enough without you wreaking chaos on our house as well. Gerald props the tree against the black metal mantelpiece and slaps the needles off his trousers. I'll fetch a sheet and drag the tree out to the garden. No, I'll tell Hetty to do that. She is as strong as an ox. She flaps a sheet of paper in the air. Cousin Stefania's written from Capri. You'd best sit down. Oh, dear. Christina perches on the chaise longue and holds the letter up to her eyes. I had thought dear Etta was much recovered from her illness after Adriana's birth, but she continues to suffer from headaches and periods of melancholia, which send her to bed for days, when even her darling child cannot rouse her from the darkness which enfolds her. Stefania will take care of her, Tina, just like she took care of you when Cecilia was born, and your husband was so ill. Etta's always been more highly strung than the other girls, but she's stronger than she looks. She'll be fine. Some things take time. There's more, Gerald. There is something I have discovered which I feel it my responsibility to tell you. Etta and Carlo are not married. He has a wife and a child. It doesn't matter how I discovered it, only that it is the unfortunate truth. I worry for Etta's immortal soul and for the child who has yet to be baptized. Etta insists that Carlo must be present and will hear nothing from me on the subject. I am torn as to what to do. But I am sure you will agree that Adriana must be baptized as soon as possible. She is an innocent in this matter. Christina looks away from Gerald's concerned gaze. The difficult month after Cecilia's birth, followed by the month she had suffered in ashamed silence in the house with her aunts after her return to London, filters into her memory. A time when no one but her father would look her in the eye, when even then she could sense his disappointment in her. And now, Etta, with the child conceived out of wedlock. History repeating itself again and again, like a curse. Why is it that the Innocenti women must suffer so for the passions that run in their blood? She drops the letter onto her lap. What are we to do, Gerald? Our daughter is living in sin with a married man, and our grandchild is outside of God's kingdom. Adriana must be baptized immediately. Yes, I see. Do you, Gerald? The whole situation reminds me of when Roberto and I were so ill after Cecilia's birth, and poor Stefania was trying to organize Cecilia's baptism. I know the situation was difficult for you, Tina. Gerald, why did you marry me? A widow with a baby? My aunts felt I was an embarrassment, just as Mama had been. That losing a husband before Roberto and I had been married a year was somehow my fault. It was my Italian blood, they said, and my baby with an Italian father. They found it all quite dramatic and shocking. Gerald, why did you rescue us? Gerald sits beside his wife on the chaise longue. He takes her hands in his. I used to watch out the window for you to pass by the photography shop, with Celie in the baby carriage, on your way down Baker Street to Regent's Park. Every Tuesday and Thursday afternoon, punctually at 3 o'clock, I thought you were the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. The day you came into the shop and asked for your photograph to be taken was one of the happiest days of my life. When you told me you were a widow, I was beyond myself. I decided then and there to do everything in my power to make you want to marry me. I love you, Tina. I've always loved you. But Gerald, Tina, I don't wish for you to rake up the sad memories surrounding your husband's death. You and our daughters have made me the happiest man I know. I hope I've made you happy. Have I, Tina? Have I made you happy? What a question, Gerald. She folds Stefania's letter. You're right. The past is the past. Etta has always been so impetuous, but she is an adult woman. She and Carlo must sort out their life together after the war is over. All we can do is offer her our support. I don't wish to do anything which causes her to prevent us from seeing our grandchild. It seems we are forever to be pulled back to that wretched island. I wish in all my heart that I'd never stepped foot in Capri. Don't say that, Tina. If you hadn't gone to Capri, you would never have had our beautiful Celie. Your husband's death was a tragedy, and it breaks my heart to think of how you must have suffered through his illness. He shakes his head. No, my dear, it was all meant to be. You must never regret that, not for one moment. Christina looks at her husband. If only he knew. What shall we do about Adriana's baptism? I'll write Etta. I'll explain to her the anguish you and Stefania are being put through about the baptism. I'm sure I can convince her to do it. We've always had a very good relationship. No, Gerald, I'll write to her. You're not even a Catholic. It's my responsibility. Christina rises from the chaise longue. Gerald, what if something happens to this Carlo Marinetti? Etta and Adriana will always have a home here. We are a family, Tina. This is all I ever wanted, and you have given me such a wonderful family, such a happy life. You didn't answer me before. Have I made you happy, Tina? Christina looks at Gerald's kind, familiar face, at the lines that are etched permanently across his forehead, on the hollowness of his cheeks. Had she done that to him? Had she sucked away his youth and his vitality because of her inability to love him the way he deserved to be loved? Of course, Gerald. Very happy. Clover Bar, Hither Green, London. February 7th, 1917. My dearest Etta, your papa and I have received a letter from Cousin Stefania, which has greatly distressed us. I am sorry that what she has to say came from her pen rather than yours. Please don't be cross with her. She did the right thing to contact us. You must know that you and Adriana are not alone in the world, no matter how much the world may be testing you at this time. We know that you and Carlo Marinetti are not married. We also know that he is already married and has a child. I am certain that you would not have embarked on the rash journey to Italy in the midst of a war had you known these things. There is nothing more dangerous to a woman in this world than a self-interested man. I do not know what he has promised you, but your father and I wish you to know that you and Adriana always have a home here at Clover Bar. You are my precious girl, Etta. I know that I do not say these things as often as I should. You remind me so much of myself before I married. I lay the blame for this unfortunate situation squarely at the feet of Mr. Marinetti. Now, to business. You must see that Adriana is baptized without delay. The situation is causing Stefania a great deal of distress, as she feels some responsibility to your child's immortal soul while you are living under her roof. You cannot wait until Carlo Marinetti is back from the war. I shall be writing Stefania after this letter to instruct her to make the arrangements. Please assure her that Papa and I shall cover any expenses. Remember me to Stefania and to Liliana, who I remember makes the most delicious torta caprese. Christina hovers the pen over the letter. She could write that Stefania had sent her the recipe, or she could tell the truth, or at least a partial truth. She is so tired of holding it all inside of her. Perhaps it would help Etta to know that she'd once been in Capri, too. She dips the pen into the inkwell. You see, I once stayed in the Villa Serenissima with Cousin Stefania when I was a young woman. What I am attempting to say is that I understand more of your situation than you will ever know. Your papa and I love you very much. Now, aside from the baptism, you must take this time to get well. Walk in those green hills. The wild flowers will be blooming shortly, and I remember how lovely it is when the poppies are out and the air is scented with rosemary. Breathe in the air. Watch the gulls swoop over the lovely blue sea. Let the island heal you, and once this war is over, come home. Your loving Mama. Chapter 55. Etta. Villa Serenissima, Capri. February 1917. Etta sets down her mother's letter on the walnut sideboard in the villa's sitting room. She walks to the window and throws it open, but even the beauty of the sea view does nothing to still the anger that is rising inside her. How did Cousin Stefania know about Carlo, about his wife and son? Celie had been the only person she had told about it. Celie must have written Cousin Stefania. How could her sister have betrayed her? How could they both have betrayed her? Ah, there you are, my dear, Stefania says as she enters the sitting room. I am going to town to pick up some things for Liliana. Would you like to come with Adriana? We can buy some cannoli, if you like. Etta's eyes narrow. How could you, Cousin Stefania? What do you mean? How could I what? She holds up her mother's letter. You told Mama and Papa that Carlo and I aren't married. You told them about Mariana and Paolo. Stefania rests a hand on the sofa to steady herself. Please forgive me, Etta. I had to. You are my responsibility while you are here. It would not have been right of me to keep that secret from them once I discovered it. Believe me, I wish I had never discovered it. Celie told you, didn't she? Don't blame your sister. I read the letter you'd written her before I posted it. You what? Am I to have no privacy here? I'm sorry, Cara, but you've been so unwell. I wanted to check that you had not simply written ramblings. Ramblings? You do not remember, perhaps, what you said and did on your worst days. I wished only to protect you and to save your sister from alarm. How can I possibly trust you after this, Cousin Stefania? I'm nothing more than a prisoner here. She juts out her chin. Like my mother was. Stefania's face blanches. Whatever do you mean? Your mother loved Capri. So she was here. Yes. Etta unfolds the letter. What did Mama mean by, I understand more of your situation than you will ever know? Stefania gestures to a settee. Come, Etta, sit down. I shall tell you something which you must promise never to tell anyone, especially not Cecilia. Why not Celie? You must promise. All right, I promise. They sit on one of the green damask settees. Stefania folds her hands in her lap and takes a deep breath. When your mother was a young woman, before she married your father, she came to visit me here for a summer, after her mother's death in the flu pandemic. Her father felt it was a good idea for her to be out of London. I was meant to teach her Italian. There was a young man that summer, a young Englishman. They fell in love, but I was blind to its intensity. I still regarded Christina as a child, you see. She was only 19. She was so sweet and happy, so innocent, so eager to experience life here. That doesn't sound like Mama. Life is difficult. It changes people, some more than others. Etta picks at a thread of the green damask upholstery. What happened with the Englishman?
He left at the end of the summer. I don't know what he had promised her, or what she had imagined would happen, but her heart was broken.
Why did you say I shouldn't tell Celie this?
Stefania sets her lips in a firm line. Etta's eyes widen.
You can't be saying...
Your mother was ill after the birth, with a terrible fever. I was worried that she had caught the Russian flu, but it was an infection from the birth. She had nightmares and hallucinations, just like you. It was a very difficult time. When she was better, she went back to England with her baby. With Cecilia. Etta stares at her cousin.
But, Papa...
Cecilia is your father's daughter in every way but that one. I am certain your mother told him the truth before they married. Cecilia must never know that Gerald isn't her real father and that she was born in 1892, not 1893. Stefania squeezes Etta's hand.
You are so like your mother was when I met her that summer, Cara. She has made a good life for herself and her child. I pray the same for you. I want you to know that you can trust me the way your mother has trusted me with her secret all these years. Now, I am trusting you. You must never tell anyone what you know.
Etta sits still, the room's silence broken only by the ticking of the grandfather clock.
What was his name?
I cannot tell you. Etta nods. She rises abruptly.
I must go feed Adriana.
Stefania watches Etta leave. She slips her rosary out of her skirt pocket. She has broken Christina's trust. She will go to confession tomorrow to cleanse her unworthy soul.
Chapter 56. Jessie. Alexandria, Egypt, February 1917. Jessie props open her copy of Baedeker's Egypt and the Sudan against the pink granite paws of the Roman Sphinx at the base of the enormous granite column.
It says here that the monolithic Pompey's Pillar was erected by the Romans in 297 AD, to commemorate the Emperor Diocletian's victory in a revolt here in Alexandria.
Archie Winter eyes the huge pillar.
Bet that hacked off the locals. It's bloody tall.
98 feet high. It's solid granite from Aswan. How do you suppose they got it all the way up the Nile to Alexandria?
Floated it, I guess.
Jessie looks up from the guidebook. You're not really all that interested, are you?
Archie shrugs. It's a pillar. Now, here's rock. That's talking. If you play your cards right, I'll show it to you sometime.
I'd have to travel to Australia for that. Archie pokes his feathered hat back off his forehead with a finger.
Never say never.
Jessie smiles.
Here, you like this, Archie? In 1803, a British ship commander named John Shortland flew a kite over the pillar and dropped a rope ladder at the top. He climbed up with one of his crewmen, waved the Union flag, and drank a toast to King George III.
Archie grunts.
They sound like Aussies.
4 days later, they climbed the pillar again, fixed a weather vane, ate a steak, and toasted the king once more.
Jessie shuts the guidebook.
So concludes our history lesson. I'm afraid I shall have to give you a D-. You're a most inattentive student, Sergeant Winter.
History was never my strong point.
What exactly is your strong point?
Archie glances around the deserted hill. He steps over a fragment of a marble column and grabs Jessie by the waist. He pushes her against the base of the granite sphinx and thrusts his tongue in her mouth. Jessie twists her head and pushes against him.
Archie, what are you doing? Stop it!
He grasps her head in his hands and plunders her mouth with his tongue. Her mind spins as she fights to breathe. She balls up her fists and beats at him until he finally releases his grip.
Don't tell me you didn't like that. Never had any complaints before.
Get away from me. Don't touch me.
She elbows past him and runs toward the road.
Your friend Harvey didn't mind,
he shouts after her. Jessie looks back to see Archie leaning against the pink granite sphinx, juggling her discarded Baedeker in his hands.
You are reprehensible.
You're nothing special, Jessie Fry. There's plenty more fish in the sea.
Good heavens, Jessie. You'll have the door right off its hinges the way you're slamming about.
Jessie flops onto her small metal-framed bed and bends over to untie her bootlaces. She throws her left boot onto the linoleum floor.
Why is it so difficult for women to go outside and not be harassed?
Ivy sticks a hair grip through her neat brown bun and pats her efforts as she regards herself in the hand mirror.
Isn't it awful in the market? All those shop sellers grabbing at you?
I didn't go there any more, unless one of the light horse boys comes along.
She rubs her lips in the mirror.
Who was that I saw you sneaking off with after lunch? Patron would skin you alive if she heard you'd been out with a soldier.
Jessie kicks off her second boot. I'd rather not talk about it. Ivy tosses the mirror onto her bed and flops down beside it.
It was that Archie Winter, wasn't it?
I have no interest in Sergeant Winter.
Ooh, Sergeant Winter now, is it? I thought you were sweet on him.
I am most definitely not.
In that case, you wouldn't mind if I got to know him better.
Jessie narrows her eyes.
Don't you think you know him well enough already, Ivy?
What do you mean?
Never mind. You'd best forget about him. He's not a gentleman.
Who needs a gentleman? I like a fellow with some gumption.
Ivy hops off the bed.
Look, Jessie, are you interested in Archie Winter or not?
Absolutely not.
Ivy adjusts her nurse's veil.
Then Archie Winter had better watch out, because Ivy de la Roche is coming.
I'm off to practice for the musical review. I'm singing Pretty Baby.
You really should join up, Jessie. You might even find yourself a mister.
Thanks, but no thanks, Ivy.
Suit yourself.
Oh, message came for you. I'll put it on the desk.
The door slams behind Ivy. Jessie pads across the floor to the desk in her stockinged feet. She picks up the note and breaks the red wax seal. The blue ink handwriting is thick-lined and impatient, more of a scribble than an attempt at clear communication.
Dear Miss Fry, I would be honoured if you would accompany me for an excursion to the souk on your next free afternoon. Please advise. Yours, Aziz Khalid.
She rereads the note. Terse, but polite. She opens the desk drawer and takes out a sheet of writing paper and a trench pen. Dear Captain Khalid, I should be delighted to join you for an excursion to the souk. I am available Thursday next. I shall meet you at the hospital's entrance gate at 2 o'clock. Yours, Jessie Fry. Aziz Khalid drops a coin into the sweet vendor's palm and hands Jessie a paper cup of ice cream dotted with green pistachios and a small flat wooden stick. It is a special ice cream from the Lebanon called Bouza. It tastes of rose water. He prods his ice cream with his stick and scoops an elastic mouthful into his mouth. Jessie scoops up the ice cream, which stretches like glue from the cup. He laughs. Twist it around the stick. Her eyes widen as the boozer's cold stickiness slides around her mouth. It's delicious. I am very happy you like it. The sweet seller is not always here. He must wait until he can buy ice from the British. Jessie licks the ice cream from her lips as they head down another of the souk's winding alleyways. What will you do when the war is over, Aziz? Stay in the army? Finally! You have said my name. You make such a fuss whenever I call you captain. I had no choice. Aziz chuckles. After the war, I shall join a hospital in Cairo, where my family lives. I may teach at the university as well. He shrugs. The path will open.
Tell me about your family.
I live with my mother and sister. My father died before the war.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. That is kind of you.
They walk on in silence for several minutes.
You never married?
Aziz glances at her sideways, his eyes lit with amusement. I was engaged to a very beautiful girl named Fatima Zahra when I was 21. Our parents arranged the marriage, but it was hopeless from the start. I was studying for my medical degree and working all hours in the hospital. My fiancé was unhappy at my inattention and broke off the engagement. I decided that were I ever to marry, it would be for love. Much to the frustration of my mother, who threatens me regularly with her imminent demise as a grandchildless woman, caused by my own selfish stubbornness.
He tosses the empty ice cream cups and sticks onto a smouldering brazier.
Tell me about your family, Jessica. You said you had a sister.
I have two sisters.
Celie is the eldest. She's the clever, studious one. She was studying German before the war broke out. She became engaged to her German teacher before he went back to Germany to join the army. They haven't been able to contact each other since. That's a terrible pity.
Maybe it's for the best. Anyway, she's now working part-time in our father's photography studio, writing for the women's page for the Daily Mirror and doing some work for the suffragists, encouraging women to become tram drivers and munitions workers, that kind of thing.
She's a busy bee, Arsili.
She sounds like you. Strong and capable.
Jessie skirts around a man who thrusts a large chameleon at her.
Then there's my twin, Etta.
She picks an ember from a barbecue grill off her sleeve.
She's petite and blonde, entirely my opposite in every way. She's the artistic one in the family. She was training to be a painter in London. Then she married an Italian artist and now has a baby girl named Adriana. She's living in Italy with relatives while her husband is off fighting in the Italian army. She is adventurous, like you. We have that in common, I suppose.
And your parents?
My father has a small photography studio in London.
My mother has the local ladies over to knit or sew for the soldiers once a week at our house. Other than that, I'm not quite sure what she does. Plays the piano, does needlepoint,
orders our maid about, attempts to matchmake her daughters. I've never really thought about it. It sounds like a lovely family. You're very fortunate. We're quite average, really. As he stops in front of a carpet shop and turns to Jessie, you are not average, Jessica. In fact, I think you are quite remarkable. He takes hold of Jessie's elbow and steers her into the carpet shop. Where are we going? Don't you know that everyone who visits Egypt must buy a carpet? They enter a vast room, stacked to the ceiling with rolled carpets of every size and colour. What am I to do with a carpet in the nurse's residence? We are in the land of Scheherazade and the 1001 Nights. What else does one do with a carpet but fly away to magic lands on it? Jessie laughs. When you put it like that, I'll at least have to take a look. Good. Then afterwards, I shall teach you to smoke a shisha. Goodness, Aziz, whatever is that? You wished for a life of adventure, did you not, Jessica? I am your humble servant, or perhaps I should say, your genie. You are full of surprises, Dr. Khalid. I had you pegged for a humourless surgeon obsessed with his work. A humourless surgeon? What an unfortunate impression. I'm having a very nice afternoon. I am as well. I hope that we might do this again, Jessica. Would that be agreeable to you? If you can get me a good price on a flying carpet, I may consider it. Like I said, I am your genie. Your wish is my command. Chapter 57. Gerald, Clover Bar, London, March 1917. Gerald shuts the bedroom door quietly behind him and crosses the Persian carpet to Christina's wardrobe. It is a territory he has never explored, and he feels a mix of guilt and naughtiness, as if he is a schoolboy about to engage in mischief. All he wishes is to borrow a pair of her gloves, to check the size for the new kid gloves with pearl buttons he plans to buy her for her birthday. She is out at Ellen Jackson's, packing gift boxes for the troops in France, and Hetty has left for the market, so this is his window of opportunity. He turns the key and swings open the doors of the large mahogany wardrobe. A crush of dresses bounces toward him as if exhaling a breath. On the upper shelf, a jumble of silk scarves and clutch purses sits among several large cardboard hat boxes. He glances nervously at the door, and, although he knows he is safely alone in the house, his heart quickens. He reaches for the hat boxes and sets them on the carpet. Stretching his arm, he then runs his hand blindly along the shelf until his fingers slide against a paper-wrapped roll. He grasps the roll and pulls it down from the shelf. The package is not one he recognizes. He can think of nothing that Christina owns that would be such a shape. Likely some memento from her father, to which she has a sentimental attachment. He lays the package on the bed and continues his search for gloves. This time, his hand finds the tooled leather cover of a book. He takes it down. The green cover is finely wrought with designs of curling leaves. He sits on the bed and opens the cover. The Diary of Christina Maria Innocenti Bishop, Capri, Italy, 1891-2. The diary is like a stone in his hands. He sets it down on the white crocheted bed cover and unties the string on the package. Released of its restraint, the roll unfurls. A young auburn-haired woman in a pale blue dress, sits amongst wild flowers on a hill, staring out at a turquoise sea, sparkling in the sun. He recognizes the face of the girl immediately. Christina,
On the bottom right-hand corner, a signature. H. Grenville. He turns the painting over. Christina, Capri, 1891. He sits and stares at the painting and the diary. He knows he should put them back, that whatever they reveal may be something he is better off not knowing. He runs his fingers over the bumps and recesses of the leather leaves. Turning the page, he proceeds to read. Chapter 58. Seeley, Heather Green, London, March 1917. Seeley braces her knees against the top of the stepladder and reaches up to clip up the corner of a painted backdrop with a clothes peg. She hears the bell ring over the studio door and calls out over her shoulder, "Just a moment, I'll be right with you." She releases the clothes peg, but it hasn't quite grasped the canvas, which curls forward like a faulty curtain. Oh, crumbs. "Careful, Miss Fry. Let me help you." Seeley turns her head. For a moment, she doesn't recognize the handsome, dark-haired army officer standing beside the bust of Caesar. "Frank? Frank Jeffreys? Is that you?" "It is." He sets his hat on Caesar's head. "Let me do that for you." "That's very kind of you." She climbs down the ladder and hands him the clothes peg. "I've been struggling with it for the past 20 minutes. I'm just a tad too short." Frank climbs the ladder and clips up the flapping canvas. "There. Is it straight?" "Perfect. I thought a country scene would make a nice change for the soldiers." She points over to a bench that has been painted to look like stone. "If you grab the other end, we can set it here in front of the backdrop."
"At your service, Miss Fry. I can be the guinea pig. I need a new portrait for my parents."
"I'm afraid Papa's out at the moment, Frank, but I can take your portrait, if you're not worried about having a woman photographer. And it's Seeley, remember?"
"That suits me just fine, Seeley."
They drag the bench across the studio's wooden floor. Frank sits down while Seeley retrieves his hat. "So, Frank, tell me all about where you've been since I last saw you in the hospital. How long ago was that?" Frank fixes his hat at a jaunty angle.
2 years in May."
"Is it really? It seems like this war will never end." She pulls out a glass plate from a wooden box and slides it into the large Marion camera. "Sit sideways slightly and look into the camera. I want to be sure to show your insignia on your epaulet. I see you're an officer now."
"Second lieutenant. They promoted me after the Gallipoli campaign. The Germans and the Turks were a misery there. They're a bloodthirsty lot."
Seeley's jaw tightens. "Yes. Well, it can't be easy for anyone on either side."
"Well, we gave as good as we got. There were far fewer Germans after the battle, and that's a good thing."
He clears his throat and coughs into his hand. He takes out a handkerchief and wipes at his mouth.
"Sorry, still rather wheezy from the mustard gas."
"You're looking rather better than the last time I saw you." Frank runs his fingers along his cheek. "Almost as good as new.
Jessie is a good nurse."
"She is that. She was on a hospital ship at Gallipoli before being posted to Egypt. She said in her letters it was awful."
"It was. I'm back in France now. At least I can get back home on leave once in a while."
A shadow chases across Frank's face. "France is awful in a different way.
This whole war is a crime."
His eyes clear, and he smiles at Seeley.
"My mother's been sending me the Mirror with her comfort packages. I've been reading your pieces. I particularly liked the one about the munitionettes. Did you know that some of the munitionettes send romantic notes to us in the artillery cases?"
"Really?"
"There's always a scrum to open the cases. Some of the fellows have begun writing back. I expect a few weddings from it after the war.
That's not a bad idea for a story, Frank, Celia says as she picks up the paisley shawl. Matches made in munitions heaven.
Your editor will be a fool to turn it down. What about you, Celia? Do you have a sweetheart in the war?
Celia laughs as she picks up the paisley shawl. It is like a knife pierces through her breast, straight into her heart. She shuts her eyes and sees Max's face, his blue eyes crinkled with laughter, his hair the colour of summer wheat. 2.5 years since she's seen or heard from him, and he still haunts her thoughts and her dreams.
Yes, I was engaged just before the war. I haven't heard from him for some time.
I'm terribly sorry. I'm sure he's fine. She looks at Frank.
His name is Max Fischer. He's German.
German? Seriously?
Yes. Seriously.
She drapes the shawl over her head and leans over the camera.
Hold still, please. I shall be done in a moment, and you can go on your way.
Gerald looks up from his desk in the photography studio. Celia is sitting on the bench, lost in thought, the soldier's portrait she has been sorting through abandoned beside her.
What is it, pet? You've been quiet all afternoon.
She sighs and collects the photographs.
I told you Frank Jeffries was in this morning.
Yes, I'm sorry to have missed him.
I can't help but think about him and Max. Both fighting.
Her shoulders slump.
I hate this war. I try to put Max out of my mind and get on with things. Then Frank asks if I have a sweetheart, and it's like Max is here with me.
Gerald shifts in his chair, wishing to go to his daughter to offer her comfort, but his ingrained reserve restrains him. His heart, already battered from his discovery that morning, aches for her.
I'm not sure anyone knows what this war is about any more, if anyone ever did.
I think Frank was mortified when I told him Max was German. I don't imagine I shall ever see him again.
I'm sure he understands, Celia. You have to set Max aside for now, though, and move on with your life, pet.
I can't, Papa. You must give yourself a chance to live, Celia, or happiness will pass you by. If I were Max, that's what I would want for you. Do you really think so, Papa?
Gerald smiles at his eldest daughter.
I do, Dove. Now, let's see those photographs.
Chapter 59. Etta, Villa Serenissima, Capri, Italy, April 1917.
There now, Stefania Albertini says, as she watches Liliana and Mario head down the steps in front of the church of Santo Stefano, hand in hand with Adriana, who toddles between them in her lacy white baptismal dress.
Adriana is a Catholic under the eyes of God, and I can sleep at night.
Etta slips Adriana's baptismal certificate into her handbag, and checks that her wide-brimmed hat is secure with a hatpin.
Mama will be happy. Another Catholic in the family.
Stefania raises her parasol against the beating sun as she and Etta walk down the steps into the piazzetta. Etta tucks her hand in the crook of Stefania's arm.
It was good of Father Izzo to let Mario be the godfather. I hope Liliana isn't too upset about not being the godmother, but it had to be you.
She is already the godmother of all of her sister's children. She needs to give the rest of us a chance at it, and I quite intend to spoil Adriana, as good godmother should.
She places a gloved hand on Etta's arm.
Wait a moment, cara mia. I have a small gift for my goddaughter.
She opens the pearl clasp on her blue velvet reticule and removes a small red satin jewellery box.
It was my grandmother's, Margarita Innocenti. She would have been your great-grandmother and Adriana's great-great-grandmother. She opens the box and holds up a delicate gold crucifix.
It's beautiful.
I take my role as a godmother very seriously, Etta. She replaces the crucifix in the box and gives it to Etta. What is it, Cara?
I wish Carlo could have been here, Cousin Stefania. Adriana will be 2 years old next month, and he's only seen her for a few days when he was here last spring.
Her smooth forehead creases.
I've been trying to sketch Carlo's face, but something's never quite right. Why can't I remember his face?
It is not necessary to remember every detail, Cara Mia. You simply need to feel your love for him, and his for you. This is how I remember my dear Federico.
I suppose so.
They walk across the bustling piazzetta in companionable silence, where men are sweeping up the dying flowers from the Easter processions. The clock tower bells strike the half hour, filling the square with resonant echoes.
I haven't received a letter from him in months.
You cannot rely on the post while we are in a war, Etta. No doubt a letter will come soon.
I suppose you're right.
She smiles.
I should be finished with Adriana's portrait this week. I'd like to have it framed.
Of course. There is a woodworker in town who can do that. You have colour in your cheeks this morning, Cara Mia. You're sleeping better?
Yes, I'm feeling much better.
Good. Now, we must hurry back to the villa for Adriana's celebration, or Mario will eat all the torta caprese bianca.
Etta sits at the desk in her bedroom, half-finished sketches of Carlo littered around her. On an easel, which Mario has made for her, Adriana's portrait regards her, the child's round face framed with gold curls. Etta looks around the large, whitewashed room. The white-painted metal bed, with its elaborate brass swirls, throws looping shadows over the east wall, and a soft breeze stirs the blue floral curtains. Adriana lies still in her wicker cot beside the bed, her curls a cap on her sleeping head. She lied to Stefania. She is not all right. Certainly her body has recovered, and at night she sleeps like the dead, the dancing monsters of her earlier nightmares no longer visiting her dreams. She can't remember the last time she dreamt at all. She is empty, like a beehive robbed of its honey. Each morning she sits in front of her vanity mirror and recreates herself, pinning her hair into soft, upswept waves, and pinching her cheeks and biting her lips until they redden into a healthy glow. She has practiced her smile until it has become second nature and chooses her dresses with care. When she is done, not even Liliana, with her knowing perceptiveness, can see that she's anything but a happy young mother. No one needs to see that she is nothing but a shell from which all of life's joy has fled.
Carlo, my darling, where are you? Are you still alive? Why don't you write me, my darling? I miss you so very much. I am dying here without you. I am so very lost.
She rises from the chair and walks over to the window. She spies Mario, long-limbed and graceless in his 15-year-old body, sitting on a tree stump in the garden, eating a pear while he bends over a sketchbook. She watches him look out over the sea to the Italian coast as his hand sweeps over the paper. An idea sprouts in her mind, like a spring flower pushing through mud. She has Adriana, and she has her art, and one day, when this wretched war is over, she will have Carlo again. What she has lacked in the long, languid days on the island is a purpose. She collects her drawing pencils and her sketchbook from her desk and heads out of the room. She has a student,
and she will teach.
Stefania shuts her bedroom door and turns the key in the lock. A ray of sunlight streaks through the window, throwing a white bar across the chest of drawers. She hurries across the Moroccan rug and unlocks the bottom drawer. Kneeling on the floor, she removes a stack of fine silk scarves and sets them on the rug. She reaches into the back of the drawer, and her hand closes on the wooden box. She sets the ornately carved box on her lap and contemplates it. It sits amongst the black fabric of her skirt like a reproach, her treachery made manifest. She opens the lid. The letters nestle inside, a neat stack of dirt-stained envelopes, addressed in Carlo's impatient handwriting to Etta. She slides a letter out of her skirt pocket and adds it to the others.
Chapter 60. Jessie. Cairo, Egypt, May 1917.
The taxi driver opens his door and shuffles from his seat with a grumble. He lifts the latch and pushes open the ornate metal gates. Beyond them, a white gravel drive curves through a green lawn and disappears around a hedge of clipped cedars, where a fiery trumpet vine has been allowed to run rampant through the dense green branches.
You live here, Aziz?
Yes. My father had it built when I was a child. He called it Altu Manina. It means tranquility. It's a good name. You would see. You would never know the city is outside these walls.
The driver climbs into his seat and shifts the cab into gear. The tires crunch over the white gravel. Around the final bend, a handsome Victorian mansion comes into view. The building's solidity is softened into an unexpected elegance by a coral pink render and the white marble balconies which hang under the tall first-floor windows. Slender cypresses thrust into the blue sky behind the mansion, as if placed there by the hand of a discerning artist as the perfect background for the house. The taxi grinds to a halt. Jessie steps out and waits on the gravel, which, at closer look, she sees is made up of chips of white marble, and waits as the driver unloads her suitcase. Aziz pays him, and the driver's sour expression transforms into a bright smile and effusive thank yous. A woman opens one of the pair of tall, green-painted front doors. She is young, perhaps a few years older than herself, Jessie thinks, and very beautiful, with delicate high cheekbones and large amber eyes framed by thick black eyelashes. She wears a long, loose jalabia over loose trousers, but rather than the ubiquitous cotton, her clothing is fine blue silk, embroidered with silver thread at the cuffs and neck. A golden silk headscarf is wrapped over her hair in an elegant turban. The young woman's full pink lips turn up into a smile, and her teeth flash like pearls in her warm complexion.
"You have brought her finally, Aziz. We have been waiting all morning."
"I'm sorry, Zara. The train was delayed at Tanta."
"No matter. You are here now."
The young woman reaches out her arms to Jessie and takes hold of her hands.
"You are Jessica, of course.
Aziz has spoken of nothing but you for months."
A pained expression crosses Aziz's face.
"Zara, please."
"Well, it's true, Aziz. I know how taciturn you can be. If you do not tell her yourself, I am more than happy to do it."
She smiles again at Jessie and squeezes her hands.
"I am Zara Khalid," she says, her R's fluttering like butterflies. "Aziz's long-suffering younger sister."
Jessie smiles awkwardly, feeling plain and ungainly in her grey cotton uniform with its ugly white collar and her functional straw boater.
"It's lovely to meet you. What a beautiful house."
Zara waves her hand languidly.
Oh, this. Yes, it is very nice, but it's my mother's domain. I cannot take any credit for it in the least. Come in from that sun. I shall have Marta set out some tea on the terrace under the awning. There's a lovely breeze of the river there.
Jessie follows Zara across the marble floor of the airy entrance hall, past the sweep of a staircase which curves around a huge chandelier dripping with rock crystals. They pass through a grand sitting room with panelled walls painted a cool blue. A large Persian rug in rich blue and gold covers the marble floor under a delicate gold Venetian glass chandelier, and elegant French settees and armchairs upholstered in blue silk damask cluster in conversational groupings around the room. Out on the shaded terrace, Zara indicates a cluster of wicker chairs with fat chintz cushions surrounding a low brass table.
Please, make yourself comfortable. We have a lovely view of the garden and the river here through the trees. I shall see about the tea. Then you can tell me all about how you met my brother.
When Zara has left, Jessie looks over at Aziz.
I must confess, I'm rather overwhelmed. I would have been quite happy staying at the nurse's residence.
Nonsense. We have much work to do, running around buying supplies over the next 2 days. We have many comfortable rooms here. It's ridiculous to have them lie empty.
It is a breathtaking house.
Jessie sits down and scrutinizes the vast, lush garden, with its rose bushes and garden walls swallowed by explosions of purple and magenta bougainvillea.
You said your father worked in the government. You didn't think about a political career?
Aziz sits in a chair beside Jessie. My father had an ability to understand and work with the British, which the Khedive Tewfik, and then his son, Khedive Abbas II, found useful. Unfortunately, my father was killed in an assassination attempt on Khedive Abbas in Constantinople a few years ago.
Oh, that's awful, Aziz. I had no idea. I'm terribly sorry.
It was a shock. My father was only 58.
Aziz shakes his head. Perhaps it was the kindest thing. His political career would likely not have lasted much longer.
Why is that?
The British deposed Khedive Abbas when he was found to be encouraging Egyptians and the Sudanese to support the Central Powers against the British in the war. My father would have been found guilty by association.
He slaps his hands on the knees of his uniform.
So, now we have a British protectorate and a new sultan, who has several impressive palaces and a comfortable life so long as he agrees with whatever the British wish, whether or not it is to the advantage of Egyptians.
He looks over at Jessie.
I'm sorry, Jessica. You're English. I don't mean to...
No. I understand.
Once this war is over, it makes every kind of sense for Egyptians to rule themselves, but I am afraid it won't be easy. At any rate, I had no interest in going into a puppet government. I saw what politics did to my father. Besides, I wished to become a doctor from an early age.
He opens his hands.
And here I am.
But you're working for the British Army.
When the war started, I knew that it would spread down to the Mediterranean because of the Turkish involvement. I felt I would be most useful doing what I could for the soldiers, who are nothing more than pawns in this whole terrible situation. Death does not respect nationalities.
What if Egypt were to become independent of the British protectorate?
That is the golden question, isn't it?
An elegant older woman sweeps through the French doors onto the terrace. There is no mistaking her relationship to Zara, with the same elegant high cheekbones and pale golden eyes, though she has rimmed hers heavily in black coal, heightening their ethereal quality.
She wears a loose black silk jalabia, a rich red silk turban and scarf, and a long double strand of pearls swings around her neck with every movement. Aziz leaps to his feet and gestures to his chair. "Mama, please sit here, beside Jessica." The older woman glances at Jessie and waves a long-fingered hand in the air, setting her gold bracelets jangling.
"Certainly not, Aziz. You are sitting there already. I prefer the settee, in any case."
Her eyes sweep over Jessie, pausing a moment too long on the plain grey cotton uniform and ugly black-laced shoes. "So, you are the English nurse Aziz has been speaking about. I trust your journey today was not too arduous?"
"No, not at all."
"You are so fortunate to be in Alexandria. I have always preferred it there, by the sea. It feels so much more intellectual with its proximity to Turkey, Greece, and Italy, and their admirable classicism, than this dusty desert backwater."
"Cairo is hardly a backwater, Mama," Aziz says. He turns to Jessie.
"Let me introduce Jessica to you properly. Mama, this is Lieutenant Jessica Fry of London, England, a nurse with the British Expeditionary Force. Jessica, permit me to introduce my mother, Madame Leila Khalid."
Leila Khalid arches a delicate eyebrow.
"Lieutenant, how very impressive."
Jessie smiles nervously. "It's because I'm an army nurse. We're all given that designation, though we call ourselves sister in the hospital." Jessie swallows, her mouth suddenly dry.
"Thank you very much for allowing me to stay here while we're in Cairo. You have a lovely home."
"You are too kind."
Zara enters the terrace, accompanied by a sturdy woman in a black skirt and full-sleeved white cotton blouse, her dark brown hair covered in a floral scarf tied behind her neck. She carries a large silver tray, which she sets down on the low brass table. She glances over at Jessica and smiles, her pale blue eyes wrinkling at the corners. Leila flicks her eyes between the housekeeper and Jessie.
"That will be all, Marta."
"Yes, madam."
"Will you need—" "I said, that is all, Marta."
Jessie glances at Aziz, whose face is set into a mask of forced composure. "There's no need to speak to Marta like that, Mama." Zara pours out a cup of fragrant black tea through a tea strainer and hands it to her mother.
"Aziz is right, Mama. Marta has the patience of one of her Coptic saints. If I were her, I would poison the flowers and change the sugar for salt and leave you on the day of one of your grand dinner parties."
Aziz's cheek twitches.
"I have no doubt, Zara."
Leila rises, as graceful as an unfolding leaf.
"I am afraid I have been taken with a headache. If you excuse me, I shall take my tea up to my room and rest."
She bestows a polite smile on Jessie. "It was a pleasure to meet you, Miss... I am sorry, Lieutenant Fry. I trust you will find your stay at Alto Manina comfortable." Jessie watches Madame Leila Khalid exit the terrace, her loose silk clothing fluttering around her slender figure in the thin summer breeze. She once saw a moth in a butterfly exhibition at the Natural History Museum, black and red, with wings that shone like oil when they caught the light. A cinnabar moth, prone to cannibalism as a caterpillar, and toxic to predators when it finally emerged from its pupa in all its adult glory. Why had she thought of that now? Aziz reaches down from his perch on one of the large beige limestone blocks of the Great Pyramid and takes hold of Jessie's hand. "Not far now. We are almost there."
Jessie rubs the back of her free hand across her damp forehead. I feel like I'm back in Miss Love's P.E. class in Lewisham.
Aziz chuckles. You'll thank me when we're at the top. The view is spectacular.
Jessie glances behind her.
Good heavens, I can see clear across to Cairo. The Sphinx looks like a cat from up here.
He tugs at her hand. Come on, Jessica. Only a few more feet. It is flat at the top. We can rest there.
Jessie follows him up the final stones.
You've been up here before?
Yes.
With a woman?
He pulls her up to the flat stones at the summit. Always by myself. I have never met a woman who would climb up here with me until you.
Jessie steps onto the summit, clutching at her hat as the breeze pulls at its brim.
Oh, my word, Aziz, this really is quite spectacular.
She points over to the next pyramid.
What's the white stone at the top of that one?
That's the pyramid of Khafre. It still has some of the white limestone casing that covered all of the pyramids at one time.
Can you imagine, Jessica? They would have glistened like great white monuments in the middle of the desert.
He points toward the Sphinx at the base of the pyramid.
Have you heard the story of the riddle of the Sphinx?
Jessie takes her new brownie camera out of her shoulder bag and aims it at Aziz.
No, but I have a feeling you're going to tell me. Just like the way you told me about the mummies and the statues and everything else in the Egyptian Museum. If you ever decide not to be a doctor anymore, you can definitely become a guide.
Are you suggesting I am a know-it-all, Lieutenant Fry?
Jessie clicks the shutter.
You? Never. I spent many, many hours in the museum in my youth. I was particularly fascinated by the mummified monkey.
She turns her camera onto the view of the white-topped pyramid.
I thought we were meant to be buying hospital supplies. I wasn't expecting a personal tour of Cairo.
I have taken care of that. My man Mustafa is arranging for everything to be put on the train for us tomorrow.
She sets down the camera and looks at Aziz.
So, I've been brought to Cairo on false pretenses.
Not in the least. We shall return with the medical supplies, and all will be well.
Like I said before, you are full of surprises, Captain Khalid.
Are you disappointed?
Not at all.
Jessie stares down at the small black box of her camera.
May I ask you something, Aziz?
Of course.
Why did you wait so long to ask me out after our first visit to Cairo? I had thought you might follow up. But you didn't.
I am sorry. I believed it was for the best. Please don't misunderstand me. I wanted to very much. But you are an English Christian, and I am an Egyptian Muslim. I told myself that you would return to England once the war is over, and I would stay here in Cairo. I told myself it would be unwise to encourage anything more than a professional relationship. I let my head dictate my heart, because I believed it was the kindest thing I could do for you.
What changed?
Ah, that is the thing of it. Nothing changed for me. I had let the genie out of the bottle. I couldn't stop thinking of you. I insisted to Matron Miller that you always assist me in the operating theatre. I refused any other nurse. Did you know that? It was the only way I could spend time with you. Then, when I saw you sitting up on the hospital roof after the blood transfusion, I knew beyond any doubt that I couldn't go on like I had any longer. I knew then that I loved you, Jessica.
He reaches out and brushes her cheek with his finger. A shock like electricity runs through her body. She picks up the camera and focuses on the Sphinx far below.
You were saying about the Sphinx?
Aziz drops his hand and looks down at the half-buried body of the Sphinx.
Ah, yes.
A Sphinx was a mythical creature with the head of a woman, the body of a lion, the tail of a serpent, and the wings of an eagle. Quite a ferocious, merciless creature who would guard the entrance to temples and cities. She would kill and eat anyone who could not answer her riddle.
I rather like the sound of her, Jessie says.
She clicks an image of the Great Pyramid's triangular shadow thrusting over the desert earth and scattered buildings as she tries to quieten her rattling heart.
There was a Sphinx who guarded the entrance to the city of Thebes. The Greek, Oedipus, travelled to Thebes, and when he arrived, the Sphinx posed him the question, "What goes on fours in the morning, on twos in the afternoon, and on threes at night?"
Jessie clicks another picture.
"And what's the answer?"
"You are impatient, Jessica. I fear the Sphinx would have devoured you."
"I think I might have been able to talk her down. I have a lot of experience with my mother."
Aziz chuckles.
Oedipus thought very carefully about the riddle. In the end, he gave her the correct answer. The poor Sphinx felt that she had no choice but to end her life, as she felt her value was bound up in having an unsolvable riddle.
Jessie sits on an ancient stone.
"And the answer?"
Aziz reaches into the breast pocket of his uniform and takes out a small black velvet bag tied with a red silk drawstring and sets it in Jessie's hand. "The answer is in here."
"In here?"
"Yes." Jessie pulls at the drawstring and takes out a small box wrapped in white paper tied with string.
"Unwrap it carefully, Jessica. The answer is on the other side of the paper."
Jessie unties the string and unfolds the paper to reveal a small red box. On the paper, something has been written in black ink.
"Will you marry me?"
Her breath catches. She looks at Aziz. He takes the red box from her and kneels on the summit of the Great Pyramid as the sun flares orange in the western sky. He opens the box and removes a gold ring set with a central diamond and two small blue sapphires.
"Aziz!"
"Jessica Fry, you are a very special woman. I have never met anyone quite like you. I would be honoured if you would take this humourless, know-it-all Egyptian doctor for your devoted husband."
"Aziz!"
"I know it will not be easy, my darling, but we shall manage. I know it in my heart. There is no one else I wish to live my life with."
"Aziz!"
"Jessica, Habibti, I love you. Will you marry me?"
"Aziz, you fool! Of course I shall."